Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, T.D. Allman, author of the controversial book Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State, has died.
From probably the 1850s till really very recently, is a fake Florida history, a fake narrative, which of a constantly reimagined Florida that never existed.
We'll discuss the West Florida Rebellion.
National and international events were factors in the West Florida Rebellion, and in turn, the rebellion shaped American foreign policy.
And we'll talk about William Pope Duval and the founding of Tallahassee. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Allman, author of the controversial book Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State, died May 12th in New York City from pneumonia. He was born in Tampa in 1944. Allman's work has appeared in numerous publications, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, Vanity Fair, National Geographic, Esquire, Harper's, and Rolling Stone. We spoke with T.D. Allman in 2013 when his book Finding Florida had just been published. By subtitling his book The True History of the Sunshine State, Allman indicated his belief that at least some of Florida's previous history is false.
I'd like to say two things about that. First of all, much worthwhile research has been done by individual scholars in Florida. There's a long list. Eugene Lyon's splendid work on the actual Spanish foundation, never quoted. A great 19th century historian, John Titcomb Sprague, who was the Thucydides of the Seminole Wars, never cited in conventional histories. But the history we know, the general history, is fictional. It was made up. It is basically neo-Confederate and racist in fundamental construction and false in everything it says up to and including the present.
At the top of T.D. Allman's long list of false Florida history is what he calls the mythology of Ponce de Leon. This year, people throughout Florida are commemorating the 500th anniversary of the naming of our state by Ponce de Leon and his discovery of the Gulf Stream, which would make future colonization and the establishment of trade routes possible. We are also recognizing that his contact with Florida's indigenous population would lead to the destruction of complex societies that had existed here for thousands of years. T.D. Allman dismisses the importance of Ponce de Leon entirely.
And they never named anything after Ponce de Leon. The Spaniards were here for 250 years. The Americans were here for quite a while, and they never named anything after Ponce de Leon. Washington Irving in the early 19th century made up the Ponce myth as it was later purveyed. And then when rich men started coming down here, notably Flagler, he wanted a nice name for his hotel, and he sort of remembered Ponce de Leon, and he named it. And that decided it. I mean, this is a very Floridian-American thing. Ponce de Leon today is a figure in American history because a rich man decided to name a hotel after him.
Some Florida historians are calling Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State, refreshingly honest. Others say that author T.D. Allman is sometimes creating controversy where none exists. For example, historians do not claim that Ponce de Leon established St. Augustine, yet Allman rightly defends Pedro Menendez de Avilés as the founder of that city in 1565. That said, not only does Almond find Ponce de Leon unworthy of recognition, he believes that St. Augustine should not be preparing to celebrate their 450th anniversary in 2015.
Their phrase is the oldest continuously inhabited city. Now, if you go there and you ask, there's not one building there that dates back before about 1820, okay? The city was emptied out many times. It would like the equivalent, what Ponce de Leon, I was thinking about this the other day, he's more like Sir Walter Raleigh. You remember those stories where Raleigh landed on the Virginia coast? But it was really only later when the people in Jamestown came in and bringing slaves with them that Virginia and America's history really began. So what you really have here, if you take these two parallel events, I think we really have to compare Menendez and his slaughter of the French. Let me just explain here what had happened. They had had many difficult and failed expeditions, the Spanish did, until finally the King of Spain banned further settlement here. He said Florida's soil was too sandy or harbors too shallow to admit a practicable settlement. That was until they found out the French had made a settlement near Jacksonville, and it was like the Bay of Pigs in reverse. Menendez tore across the Atlantic. He slaughtered the French, hundreds of them, more than 100 of them. And as I say in my book, it was this first mass slaughter of white men by white men that really started our history, just as it wasn't Raleigh and the Pocahontas myth, but the arrival of serious slavery in Jamestown that marked the beginning further north and so on. So I think we need to look at the realities. Today we face great problems in the United States and in Florida. If you read my book, Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State, you will have a much more interesting story than anything you ever learned in school. Now, the other thing is, if you look at history as it actually happened, then you can understand things. Why do we have invasive species? Well, we are an invasive species because of Florida's subtropical location. And you go through all these things, and what I found fascinating is what normally seems sort of silly in Florida history, like the Ponce de Leon myth. Once you dig underneath, very fascinating things are happening.
Some Florida historians are saying that T.D. Almond's frank, critical analysis of Florida's Civil War and Reconstruction era and the historians who wrote about them is long overdue. Others believe that Almond is unnecessarily harsh in his critique and say that his commentary sometimes descends into gratuitous name-calling. For example, Carolyn Mays Brevard wrote an early history of Florida following the Civil War. She writes from a particular Southern perspective, to be sure, but Almond labels her a white supremacist. He is very critical of Florida historians of the late 19th and early 20th centuries and unapologetic about his descriptions of them.
Harsh, these are value judgments. I tell what really happened, and I have a chapter in my book called Florida's Fake History. I'll repeat, Florida's Fake History. And I give the great poobah Florida historians their due. But, you know, it's not just the publicists, the propagandists, the people who really have tenure from the Chamber of Commerce. Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., the revered icon of the Northeastern elite Ivy League establishment, his book on Jackson is twaddle when it comes to Florida. Because Andrew Jackson, as we all understand, played a very important role here. I could explain what that role is if we had enough time. But since Jackson's excesses here, to put it mildly, do not fit into Schlesinger's schema that Jackson was really a rather innocent frontiersman when he became president, he simply leaves out Florida. And Jackson's, and one of the things you may remember from high school or grade school is how Jackson came down here and hung two Englishmen. What we don't learn is that was part of one of the first great constitutional crises in the United States, in which pitting Jackson against Monroe. And Schlesinger just leaves this out. So at every, I don't know why so many historians go along with it. The one historian, let me talk about, and I will say, is Florida's greatest living historian. He's a man named Cantor Brown. He never got tenure. He's not head of any Florida history department. He teaches in Georgia. And he's done wonderful work on Ossian Hart. If you've never heard of it, go find out who Ossian Hart is. And he was writing basically the kind of stuff I am writing 20 years ago. And he went to one of the old professors who was going to get him tenure somewhere. And he said, Now, young man, you don't want the Florida tail wagging the Southern dog. And that's how you were expected to fit in. And when I write, and when I write books, I don't care whether I fit in. What I care is whether I get the truth. And so did Cantor Brown. And there are a number of other very good historians as well.
Florida's modern tourism industry and aggressive land development really began in the late 1800s. Harriet Beecher Stowe was one of the early proponents of Florida as a paradise for both visitors and new residents. T.D. Allman believes that the efforts to develop tourism and sell real estate has led to more Florida myth-making.
Yes, I mean, the hurricane arrives on scene in the very first incident of recorded Florida, of important Florida history, this massacre of the French that I mentioned. But you'd think Harriet Beecher Stowe, the great abolitionist, Lincoln said, oh, so this is the little woman who tore a country apart or something to that effect. She came down and she had a place on the St. John's River, which is not a river in Jacksonville. Go to your geology books or my book to find out what it really is. And she became a great propagandist for Florida. And when one of her guests dared to suggest that it got cold in Florida and that they had disease here, she was really quite irritated. And she said, really, this doctor, one might think he was a hypochondriac. And then she added, besides, the malaria in Florida is of the milder sort.
In his book, Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State, T.D. Allman takes the reader from prehistory to the present. He says that for more than a century and a half, Florida has been falsely mythologized as a paradise, and that historians have been complicit in the misrepresentation.
From probably the 1850s till really very recently, is a fake Florida history, a fake narrative, which of a constantly reimagined Florida that never existed. You see, although they make up a mythological Florida, that Florida is constantly changing because it's the duty of this mythic Florida to correspond to what people often who have no interest in the facts and no interest in knowing wish it to have been. So if you went back, say, 60 years to like, or let's say go back to before World War II, or even quite recently, you would have people who would call history books published in the 50s describe slavery as the greatest institution for civilizing African savages that had ever been developed. You had chapters in supposedly respectable history books called The War of Southern Independence, if not the War of Northern Aggression. Now, those also painted Florida as this ideal place which had always been right pleasant. But, of course, then it was the darkies and the slaves. And now today, if you go to the same kind of people, they're saying, of course, slavery was evil, but, of course, it was always very nice. So you have this constant reinvention. Things are simpler for me because I stick to the facts.
T.D. Allman, author of the controversial book Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State, died last month in New York City. We spoke with T.D. Allman in 2013 when Finding Florida had just been published. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Goodbye, Joe. Me gotta go. Me, oh my, oh. Me gotta go pull the Piro down the bayou. My Yvonne, the sweetest one, me oh my oh. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the West Florida Rebellion is perhaps not that well known, but it did have a significant impact on American history, right?
Yes, it did. One of the most unusual special issues of the Florida Historical Quarterly was published in fall 2011. What made it unusual was its focus on what in 1810 was called Spanish West Florida, an area between the Pearl River and the Mississippi River in what is now the state of Louisiana. It was the scene of the so-called West Florida Rebellion that occurred under the Lone Star flag of the West Florida Republic. President Thomas Jefferson's purchase of the Louisiana Territory from the French in 1803 did not include all of modern-day Louisiana. The territory that lay between the Mississippi River on the west and the Pearl River on the east was claimed by Spain, although a significant number of American citizens had settled in this region, and they believed the area rightfully belonged to the U.S. As Hyde notes in his introduction to the special issue, the area had been successively claimed by France, Britain, and Spain, and was a chaotic cauldron of divided loyalties, overlapping land claims, and differing perspectives on the nature and purpose of government. In addition, Spain's hold on the area was weak. The only significant garrison was located at Pensacola, with smaller posts at Mobile and Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge had only 30 or so soldiers to defend Spanish claims.
And Spanish control over West Florida was contested by three different factions, right?
It was. The American faction resented their exclusion from the Louisiana Purchase and advocated annexation by the United States. Spanish loyalists held lucrative land grants and enjoyed little interference from the Spanish government. Most paid little or no taxes and were free from the types of services like jury duty that are required of citizens. Finally, there were independents who wanted to create their own nation. During the summer of 1810, plans for the rebellion were completed, and on September 23, 1810, American settlers attacked and overran Fort San Carlos in Baton Rouge. They declared themselves under the rule of the Republic of West Florida and established the capital at St. Francisville. On December 15, 1810, Congress declared the territory part of the United States, although Spain did not cede the area until 1819 and the signing of the Adams-Onis Treaty.
Well, Connie, how is this scuffle in the wilderness a factor in national and international events?
Jim Cusick argued in his article that both East and West Florida of the era represented not a frontier but a borderland. That is, an area in which borders are porous and loyalties are weak and influenced by competing government structures and regulations. He notes that on the borderlands, concepts of loyalty are highly localized, and self-interest and self-protection are the chief traits of border residents. Authority in borderland areas was subject to challenge not by the oppressed, he wrote, but by the ambitious and discontented. In the period 1778 to 1818, the borderlands of the Floridas were marked by 14 episodes of conspiracy, revolt, and invasion. Encouraged by the shifting European alliances created by the Napoleonic Wars that left their American claims unattended and white hunger for indigenous land, violence and rebellion characterized the borderlands of both the East and West Florida. Steve Belko ties the West Florida Rebellion to the establishment of American foreign policy, specifically the creation of the Monroe Doctrine. On October 27, 1810, acting on reports of the West Florida Rebellion, President James Madison met secretly with his cabinet and issued the No Transfer Resolution, a statement denying the right of European powers to transfer land in the Western Hemisphere to other European nations. It was ideologically fundamental to the Monroe Doctrine of 1823. Acting on the President's request, Congress confirmed the No Transfer Resolution and the occupation of West Florida to the Perdido River. In December 1811, Congress admitted Louisiana to the Union, including the area between the Pearl and Mississippi Rivers. National and international events were factors in the West Florida Rebellion, And in turn, the rebellion shaped American foreign policy.
Interesting as always. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
Jumbo line, a crawfish pie, and a filet gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna see Mama Shazamio. Pick guitar, fill fruit jar, and be gay-o. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou.
This is Florida Frontiers. William Pope Duval was instrumental in the founding of our state's capital. Sebastian Garcia has more.
James Mike Denham is a professor of history and a director of the Lawton Childs Center for Florida History at Florida Southern College in Lakeland, Florida. He's also the current president of the Florida Historical Society and the author of Florida founder William P. Duval, Frontier Bon Vivant. I spoke with Professor Denham about William Pope Duval and the founding of Tallahassee. Duval was born in 1784 as a Virginian aristocrat. His father was the mayor of Richmond and a veteran of the American Revolutionary War. Indeed, Duval leveraged his father's political connections to advance his own political aspirations. In addition to his political skill, such a position enabled Duval to successfully become Florida's first real territorial governor.
When he was in Congress, he made many contacts, very important contacts. Of course, he used his father's background to associate with people like John C. Calhoun. Of course, Andrew Jackson was really not yet a powerful force, but he would be after the Battle of New Orleans. But anyway, he established connections, deep connections to the political leadership. So fast forward about 10 years, and he is broke because the banking crash of Kentucky, and he's desperately seeking a job. So he is appointed to the new territory as district judge, and he comes to St. Augustine, and he's there only pretty much long enough to be sworn in, but then he goes back to Washington and lobbies for appointment to become Florida's first real territorial governor. Now, Andrew Jackson, of course, had been in Pensacola for a few months, but he really didn't serve as a governor per se. It was really Duval who was the first real territorial governor of Florida, and he served until 1834. That's a long time, about 1822 to 1834.
One of the most pressing issues that engulfed Duval's territorial governorship was establishing a new capital for the territory of a unified Florida, one that was sensitive to the long distance and dangerous traveling conditions between Pensacola and St. Augustine, the former capitals of West and East Florida, respectively.
Both towns had seats for the legislative council, and it was clear that they didn't want to keep alternating that situation. The safest way to travel from St. Augustine to Pensacola was not by road. They didn't have I-10. was by water. So you would get on a boat in St. Augustine, sail all the way down the Atlantic coast, go around to the very, very dangerous Straits of Florida, and then go through there and then come back all the way up through the Gulf and then sail to Pensacola. So there were really no roads other than Indian trails. So road building was infrastructure was a big issue that Duval had to deal with. It was precarious. And that leads us into the story of the founding of Tallahassee.
As with most origin stories, the founding of Tallahassee blends the boundaries between history and myth.
There's a myth that Duval commissioned John Lee Williams and John Hayne Simmons to found a location in the middle of the territory to build a capital, as if they're like Lewis and Clark, one coming from St. Augustine, the other coming from Pensacola, and they're supposed to somehow meet in the middle and roam around and find this location. Well, that's really pretty ridiculous. They knew exactly where they were going. Why? Well, because that area had been traversed by Andrew Jackson and his men. Remember, Andrew Jackson brought about 1,000 soldiers to Florida in 1819 to flush out the area, capture individuals who they were convinced were creating, fomenting Indian attacks across the international border. So they came all through this area that we're here in now in Tallahassee, and they were astonished at the fertility of the soil and the potential.
Indeed, this potential of fertile soil meant that Tallahassee and its surrounding area quickly became a lucrative site for slavery. The expansion of the peculiar institution motivated many American leaders and enslavers to acquire Florida and promote settlement into the territory.
Duval's main task was to spread the word, spread the gospel of how wonderful this area was, and support and promote settlement, and work with people with money, people in Maryland, people in Virginia. The surest path to wealth was through acquisition of land and slave labor to produce cotton. And so we need to think of Florida as the virgin territory of what would become the Old South, 1820s, 1830s. We all know that Alabama and Mississippi was filling up like mad, but we all often forget that the six or seven upper counties, two or three on each side of Leon County, Gadsden and Jackson to the west, Jefferson and Madison to the east, turned out to be incredibly, incredibly fruitful and valuable for settlement. And so within a generation and a half, this area flourished and was equal in production of cotton to any other three counties in the Old South. The path that Florida was on economically, socially, politically, was in alignment with what was taking place in the other areas of the Old Southwest. That meant slave production and production of cotton, which made many people very wealthy, but it, of course, it came at a tremendous cost. So Florida was part of this great migration of people from Virginia and Maryland and South Carolina into Florida. And that was certainly a lasting legacy, for good or ill.
Anniversaries often provide contentious opportunities to reexamine, debate, and negotiate historical legacies. 2024 marks the bicentennial of the establishment of Tallahassee. Professor Denham offers his perspective on William Pope Duval and the founding of Tallahassee 200 years later.
There are those who say that we should not be wasting our time commemorating or celebrating, if we want to call it that, a event which really precipitated antebellum Florida's experience with antebellum slavery. And of course, I can certainly understand that. But I think recognizing that, both the positives and the negatives, of course, it's mostly negative, I think it's important for us to understand all of the complexities and all of the drama, but also the choices that people make as each individual lives their lives. They are part of the human experience, and anything they did, which we can see as physical evidence or a result of that, I think is worth studying. Because here we are. We're in the capital of, what is it, the fourth or fifth largest state in America, in the United States, 22 million people. The fact that we're here means that something important happened here. I mean, it just didn't pop up out of nowhere. These are complicated questions, and there's a lot of ambivalent answers to these things, but I think it's certainly worth knowing, if only to kind of understand how we got here.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.